Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, and welcome into The Conversation on TYT. I am your host, Adrienne Lawrence, and I have an incredible guest today. You may know her. It's Dr. Maya Rockeymoore Cummings. She's the former chair of the Maryland Democratic Party, also author of a forthcoming book called Racism, Race, Age, Gender Exclusion, and the Politics of Health Equity. That's supposed to come out in 2021. Thank you for joining us, Maya.
Thanks for having me, Adrienne.
Yes. And so, hey, this everything is everything, from COVID-19 to this kind of uprising and movement. And I know you are a huge proponent of this New Deal. What is your vision? Tell us a little bit about that.
So, you know, we have a hugely terrible situation happening in this country, and that is that we have no leadership. You know, it's a form of, I'd say, genocide by administrative malfeasance. A large number of people will be killed when this is all said and done, simply because we had an administration that was unwilling and unable to put together a national strategy and implement it correctly. And so now what we're seeing is today we've had the highest single day peak in the history of coronavirus, with more than 36,000 new cases reported as of today. And then you know, we've got 7 states across the country that have the also highs, and of course more than 33 whose numbers are rising again. So this is a tragedy in the open. This is a tragedy in the making. And we need to get a handle on this. So I call for a bold new deal for COVID-19. We've got, and if the administration is not going to lead, we need Congress to lead. And this is a 3-part strategy. The first part is absolutely, we need national testing that's targeted towards vulnerable communities. We need contact tracing. We need isolation when necessary. We need personal protective equipment for those who are on the front lines. So that's just the first part of the strategy. The second part of the strategy is immediate access to healthcare. So we've got a lot of frontline workers and others who are still uninsured. We need to be opening up Medicaid nationally or allowing people to get on Medicare. This is an emergency and we need to treat it as such. And then we need to, of course, more in the intermediate long term, we need to move to a national single payer system. And then the third thing we need to do, of course, is all about economics. Our countrymen and women are actually hurting, and we need to make sure that they have, you know, the wherewithal to sustain themselves. So the 2-part strategy on economics is actually finally getting around to infrastructure, because it needs to be a stimulus. It's going to be of grand proportion. So an infrastructure deal for the nation is important. But then a federal jobs program needs to be a part of that, where anybody who wants a job can get a job, and that they have work to do all over this country. So, you know, we've got a 3-part strategy, and it's a bold new deal for COVID-19. It's dealing with both the economics and the health, and we need to get to it.
And you know what, Dr. Cummings, it's interesting because this deal sounds so commonsensical, but it's so bold in the current climate in which we're in, because you're absolutely right in terms of the malfeasance, misfeasance and nonfeasance, just a whole lot of nonsense going on when it comes to our leadership. And something you had mentioned were the vulnerable communities. I was looking at a report from the Economic Policy Institute that was released recently that talked about how Black workers are facing 2 of the most lethal pre-existing conditions for the coronavirus, which would be racism and economic inequality. So I guess, how is one way in particular that we can help reduce some of the burdens that are on the Black community?
So, and on the health side, we need to open up access. African Americans and Latinos are amongst the highest uninsured populations in this country. And so, you know, the opening up of access, whether through Medicaid or Medicare, to healthcare is an absolute essential. On the job side, again, when I talk about federal jobs, you know, when we're looking at the unemployment numbers, they're disproportionately Black and brown. And so that means that, you know, jobs are a big deal because that's the income. As you well know, for every dollar of wealth held by the typical white family in the United States of America, African Americans only own 5 cents, a nickel. And so, you know, we've got a history of marginalization in this country, and we need to make sure that we don't fall further through the cracks as a result of the coronavirus. And that means that, you know, we have to have guarantees and income, protection of what little wealth we have. But we also need job guarantees. And of course, food security should be added to that, and housing security should be added to that.
Absolutely. It seems that housing is a significant issue for a lot of people right now, especially with people not necessarily having jobs. And I've definitely seen an uptick in the number of unhoused around me here in Los Angeles. Kind of what do things look like in Maryland right now?
So it's looking the same all over the country. People are, you know, if they don't have the income to pay rent or to pay their mortgage, they're looking at a crisis of epic proportions, being put out on the street, literally. Now, here in Maryland, we still have some protections in place from the governors, but we don't know how long that's going to last. There needs to be a national guarantee that people will be protected during this time, especially since it's been mandated at the highest levels of our federal government that we must reopen our economy with no assurance of employment for many of those who have lost their jobs due to the coronavirus. You know, just think about the restaurant industry. Many of those jobs, those restaurants are never opening again. The people who are employed by the restaurant industry are disproportionately Black and Brown. And so, you know, we're talking about a destabilization and a displacement that's not going to be solved just by saying magically open up the economy. We have work to do to protect people as we help them realign, reestablish themselves, and perhaps even retrain and educate themselves for a new economy.
Absolutely. And something kind of that maybe resonates with me a little bit more is the fact that we have this uprising here when we have these protests. And fortunately, you know, the coronavirus is not spreading, you know, at least that's what the researchers say, because of these protests. And one of the big issues seems to be defunding the police. And something that I think you would be probably particularly knowledgeable about is the fact that Baltimore tried in kind of reforming the police, and they really fought every step of the way. But they can be a good case study. And so can you talk a little bit about that in terms of how the Baltimore police and the changes that they made may be something we can look at when we talk about how we're going to change policing?
So 5 years ago, the riots that you're seeing, the unrest that you're seeing, what happened here in Baltimore with the death of Freddie Gray, who was in police custody when somehow his spine got severed and a few days later he died. And all over the city, African Americans, particularly those in low-income neighborhoods who had been harassed by the police and mistreated, they were basically upset and frustrated, and they were done. So we saw the same kinds of, you know, fires burning. We saw the police vehicles that were, you know, trashed happening right here in Baltimore City. So the Obama administration came in. They actually did a study. They found out that there was a lot of racism and classism in our system, and that there was unconstitutional policing going on. They actually mandated a consent decree. And then as a part of that consent decree, we were required to actually have a citizens review board to actually oversee the new changes that were expected for the police department. So how has it gone? I would say that, you know, the Fraternal Order of the Police, which is the police union, has fought everything, every step of the way. The progressive state's attorney tried to actually prosecute the police that were involved in the Freddie Gray murder. And she had to drop the charges because they were harassing her. They were going after her law license. They were calling her everything but a child of God. You know, certainly the Citizens Review Board has been, you know, the city has constantly been on their back trying to prevent them from getting information from the police department, trying to shield themselves from lawsuits, et cetera. So it has been a slow and difficult road and very hard fought. Most recently, the city council has actually opted to defund the police, meaning that they are seeking to actually transfer some of these dollars away from the police department. But we have a strong mayoral government here in the city of Baltimore. And it looks like some of those recommendations from the city council may not even be implemented. So, you know, Baltimore is a case study, and we're still fighting it out here in Baltimore, and it's going to be a pretty hard row to hoe in cities across the country.
All right. It does sound like it's going to be quite the journey. And kind of just maybe sticking a little bit in Baltimore, you know, you've been in politics for a long time, where you were the former chair of Maryland Democratic Party. Also, your late husband, Elijah Cummings, he was a devoted member of Congress, 23 years? And so you've really seen kind of the political growth and development over the years. I guess, what gives you hope based on what you see now?
What gives me hope is the global protests. The fact that everybody saw, the murder in Minneapolis, of George Floyd, and they clearly understood it to be murder. And they clearly understood at that moment in time that we have a problem here in the United States of America. And people are standing up and speaking out, and they're saying no. They're saying no to establishment politics, which means that, you know, the DAs who are in bed with the police departments around the country, they're asking to break those local protection rackets. They're calling for new and better policies at the federal and state levels. And so, you know, we need to keep the protests up, because through these protests, we're actually seeing movement. And we've got to keep protesting, and certainly other forms of engagement, to ensure that there is actual change.
Yeah, and it's been interesting, too, in seeing kind of the change edge forward a little bit, where you have these kind of government entities now willing to change their budget, even if slightly a little bit. So it definitely is important that we keep up the pressure. But I guess, what do you possibly foresee as becoming backlash with this pressure and social change?
So the backlash is always there. We've lived the backlash for the last 4 years, and we've lived it because we had the first ever African-American president. So the backlash to the first Black president was, you know, the far right wing basically saying never again, no more. But we're going to have the backlash to the far right wing and white nationalism, because that's what these global protests are all about. In addition to protesting police brutality, violence, and murder, it's all about structural racism and what we need to do to dismantle it here in America and around the world. So, you know, this is bringing me hope. It's bringing a lot of people hope, but we've got to keep up the pressure.
Absolutely. And something to kind of note about around the world is what the European Union, there's kind of whispers, hints right now, the thought that they may block Americans from, you know, coming over to visit. And the Canadian border is still locked. And I believe the Mexican border is also still locked. So I guess, how is this going to situate us when it comes to international relations if everyone doesn't want to play with the dirty kids from America?
So the fact of the matter is that we've lost global esteem over the last 4 years. I mean, this is just piling on to our eroded position already. In the space of the 4 years, as a result of Donald Trump's, you know, mismanagement of the country and certainly of international relationships and our historical partnerships, we basically seen, countries around the world turn their backs on the United States of America. And right now, the closing of the borders is completely rational because we have not managed the coronavirus. And so they're protecting their populations. And yes, Americans are global travelers, but it should be clear to Americans that, you know, that this is very serious indeed when other countries are actually closing their doors to American tourism because you said we're dirty, we're diseased. Because of the mismanagement. And so, you know, change in leadership is what we need in the fall. Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say disease, and from a lot of people's, you know, mindset, we just some nasty kids people don't want to play with. And it's unfortunate because, you know, hey, I'm trying to get out of here. But here I am and we're all here. But I guess let me kind of ask you, in terms of, since we're going to be here for a while, what do you think that local entities in terms of governors can do, as we just saw Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey partner together to say they are enforcing quarantines from outsiders? I guess, what can these individual states do to make this better?
So states can actually develop their own statewide plans, which is what they've essentially been doing. But they can't bow to pressure from, you know, these right-wing activists that are saying, you know, we're libertarians. We don't want to wear masks. Well, guess what? Public health is in the public interest. And public health sometimes needs to supersede individual liberties. And this is one of those cases. When you're in a pandemic, and anybody could die just by being in proximity to anybody else. This is serious business. This is a national security issue, and it needs to be framed as such. So what state governors and mayors and county officials can do is certainly enforce common sense public health measures. You know, masks and gloves and eye protection, common sense. Making sure that we have testing and contact tracing, common sense. Making sure that we do the work of isolating individuals who actually have cases of coronavirus, common sense. And all of that can take place at the state and local level. And certainly we've seen some leadership in places across the country, but we need to see more, much more.
All right, and kind of just like maybe theoretical guessing. What would you say is the reason we have so many of these libertarian ideologies with this thought of we can't wear a mask, we're rejecting science? How did we get here?
I think that it's been stoked. I think that it's a right-wing conspiracy to actually, you know, put the message in the minds of their base to say, you know, we're resisting this. But let me just say this also, that the coronavirus hit blue states first. And so people, you know, the reality of it was very, you know, in the consciousness of people living in blue states. Now, you know, we're seeing it move to red states. And now people in red states are actually understanding this thing is real. It's not anything fabricated on television. It's actually happening all across the country. And so with that, you know, I do think when the reality, and there is nothing more real than a pandemic with life or death health consequences. When the reality hits the rhetoric, reality is going to win every time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Some people need to learn the hard way. And it's unfortunate because it means, you know, since it's this whole contagion thing that we all could end up learning because they don't want to listen. But we are doing the best we can. And really, when it comes to the best, you know, we had the situation those few months ago where we didn't have the PPE, the protective equipment we needed, and also people were having food scarcity issues. What do you think is going to be different this next time when we kind of have that second phase come through?
So, you know, I think that we're seeing hospitals still rationing their equipment. So we're not out of the woods with regards to PPE. It's not over. And unfortunately, our federal government, you know, some of the companies that were actually selling and stocking us with these materials were giving them away at the instruction of our federal government to other countries early on in the pandemic, which made us less ready and prepared when it became apparent that this was going to be an issue for the United States of America. So, you know, the reality is that, you know, we're not out of the woods with PPE. We're not out of the woods with hunger. We're not out of the woods with income insecurity. And it's likely we won't be out of the woods for the next several years until a virus is a vaccination is found. You know, this is going to be something that we're going to be living with for quite some time. Now, the race to a vaccine is on. And, you know, I've gotten some indications that the United States has been involved in the World Health Assembly in a negative way, basically rejecting, you know, the whole notion that we should have, you know, a pooled patent amongst nations so that whoever finds a vaccine can share it with others in the other countries in the world. I've heard it that the United States was one of two countries that opposed that proposal. And that indeed that the United States of America is looking to go it alone to make sure that they're protecting the potential patents of pharmaceutical companies who are based here in the United States instead of being concerned with the livelihoods of people around the world and the health and the well-being of these people. So, you know, we've got to be concerned. I think it's time to get this man out of office. It's time, you know, if he's protecting pharmaceutical companies and their huge profits that they already have in this pandemic at the expense of American lives and global lives around the world, then, you know, we have no choice. People need to become educated. They need to mobilize. They need to make sure that they turn out to vote in the fall. We have no choice. It's time for Donald J. Trump to go.
Yes, and you're absolutely right in terms of vaccine. That was something that concerned me greatly based on our behavior with the World Health Organization pulling out of that and essentially isolating ourselves from all of our allies, that we are going to be in a situation where people aren't going to want to share the vaccine with us. And That's not going to be cool at all.
Not cool at all.
Nope, not at all. Well, since we only have a few more minutes, I was going to ask you, what do you think is the biggest issue that's not getting coverage right now?
You know, there's so much, I think, facing the world. But, you know, I think a big issue that we need to focus on is, you know, making some, you know, demands of the Democratic Party. We're at a critical crossroads here. And I think the Democratic Party needs to understand that if they're going to get the vote of Americans in the fall, that they need to actually step up and have a stronger paradigm for legislating and policymaking in a new administration and a new Congress. And so that means that everything that I'm talking about with regards to a bold new deal for COVID-19 and all subsequent stimulus bills that are coming out, they need to make sure that they're leaving no one behind. We know that in this last CARES Act that they passed, that, you know, more than 90% of Black and Latino-owned businesses did not get any money from the PPP program. That is unacceptable for communities that are actually rising in terms of the percentage of the population, for policymakers on Capitol Hill to actually be legislating in a way that excludes still in the 21st century. That means that we need to do a check in terms of how we're legislating. And we need to make sure that this is, that equity is the name of the game at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level.
Absolutely. And one final question, if you will indulge me, it's my favorite. What is your most irrational fear?
My most irrational fear is that I will not be able to travel the way that I want to, for at least several years. You know, I love traveling abroad, but I guess it's rational, but it's irrational.
It is, unfortunately, pardon me, like it was irrational at one point in time, but now looking pretty real.
Yeah. So, you know, I love to travel. And, in terms of politics, my most irrational fear, this also rational, is that somehow this man finds a way to stay in office for another 4 years. I think our country will be devastated and decimated if there were another 4 years of this.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Maya Rocky Moore Cummings. And can you tell everybody where to find you?
Yeah, sure, Adrian. You can certainly go to MayaForCongress.com or GlobalPolicySolutions.com for more information.